Welcome to Wild Quincy, a podcast that looks into the little-known and forgotten past of Quincy, Illinois.
Folklore of Adams County has been a staple of Wild Quincy for a few seasons now, but we really never knew anything about the author. So in this episode, we dive into the life of the man himself, Harry Middleton Hyatt, with another man who actually knew the author, attorney and former mayor of Quincy, Chuck Schultz. That coming up next.
Now, here's your host, Chris Ketters and Travis Hoffman.
So we go from a mad scientist to, well, a doctor, another type of doctor. We'll talk about that coming in a few minutes, but another episode of Wild Quincy coming your way. Travis, how's it going, man? You doing good?
We're rolling through another episode. This one took us a little while to get to. Appreciate the patience on everything. We had a scheduling and sickness, and gosh, it's just been one of those seasons. It's been hard to keep everything on this. We appreciate everyone's patience is what I'm getting to. Thanks so much. But no, everything's good. How have you been?
Besides sickness, been doing good. Yeah, it's been kind of a crazy couple weeks, and we were just talking about I'm taking classes now, and we got night classes starting. It's just, it's that time of year, right? It's always crazy, crazy go all the time. So,
a lot going on.
Well, and I'm sure you guys are the same. We're getting into spring. We're getting closer to this, getting away from this cold weather and moving to the spring. But with the rise of flowers and the blooming of the dogwood trees, we come and find ourselves with new Patreon members. Does that connect?
You went one way and I wasn't expecting that. Yeah, okay. A for effort there, Chris.
Thanks, man.
Let me bail you out of this weird tangent you're on. So yeah, we do have some new patrons, new additions, new seedlings to the wild things that grow. We want to appreciate and send a warm thank you to Renee Carlson, who joined us at the $5 medium just special level. Mark Esnault, forgive me, Mark, if I'm mispronouncing that last name, he joined us at the $5 medium Jeff special level. And Cindy Bailey joined us as well at the $5 medium Jeff special level. Thank you, guys. And you know, Chris, it's been a while. We haven't thanked our $20 Hostess Will Seat You Now business level sponsors in a while, and they are still hanging on. And we want to send out another special thank you to Cooking with Carly, and that you can find out more at cookingwithcarly.com. That's C-A-R-L-E. EE.com. She has a collection of family recipes, family friendly and favorite recipes, both old and new. Started just trying to keep kind of all family recipes together and end up in this awesome blog. We've made multiple things, my wife and I, and they've all been delicious. Thank you for her continued support. And also, Lions Pride, our first of business sponsors who to come on board and still hanging strong. Lion's Choice, you can find out more at quincydj.com. They are the premier DJ, karaoke, photo booth, and officiating services provider. And a pretty trippy, awesome logo as well. I love their big lions. I have to drive by it every day to go to work where it's parked in storage. And I'm always makes me smile. It's pretty awesome. So we thank Lions Pride and Cooking with Carly. And if you want to get the business shout out, you can do so jumping over to Patreon and joining us at $20 a month. Hostess Will Seat You Now. You'll get a link, a banner on the website, as well as a shout out from time to time here on the podcast. So if you're looking for a way to get a little exposure to your business maybe and want to give us a little support, we'd love to have you on board. So thank them as well as every other wild thing that helps keep the lights on over on the Patreon side.
Yeah, special shout out to a good buddy of mine, Matthew Brogdon, who's been a huge supporter of Patreon and Wild Quincy.
Yeah, technically he's the first actual business sponsor, isn't he?
Yes,
you're a madman, Matthew, and we love you. Yeah.
Yes, yes, numerous times like, Matt, come on, man, you don't need to do that. And he still just wants, he's like, well, it's better spending it on you guys than spending on lottery tickets.
Well, so we appreciate that. And if you ever have a business venture you want to promote, Matthew, please.
Yeah, let us know.
Don't forget you keep continually contributing on such a crazy level, which we thank you for.
We definitely appreciate it. So anyway, that's a look at our Patreon members. We'll have a little promo coming up your way to give you all the details. But I think we're over 60 now Patreon episodes over there on the Wild Things side. So yeah,
got check some those people out. Checking out the free trial membership too. And you can, what is that, a month or something? You get 30 days to try and
like
jump in there and listen as much as you can. So if you're looking to kind of just dip your toe in the water, that's a good way to get in there and check it out as well.
We do. I've been rewatching the show Community. It's on Netflix. It's getting ready to go off Netflix. And it was funny because they came up with that they were going to have a bottle episode. And so I like chuckled because I'm like, well, we've had a few of those on the Patreon side. So anyway, yeah, check those out. We got all those on there. Sometimes it's related to the stuff we're talking about. Sometimes it's just us sitting there possibly having a nice beverage and just discussing Quincy and how much we love it.
There you
And food. A lot of food.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. Before we get into this episode with our special guest, we, of course, have to do a question of the day. I feel like, Travis, that you didn't do so successful last episode.
No, it sucked.
Well, I wouldn't put it that hard.
That's kind of been the theme this last couple times here. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what to say about this.
Don't say anything, Chris.
Okay.
Sometimes silence speaks volumes.
There you go. Well, let's get you this question of the day. Here you go. In the 1860 election, we're kind of by the way expanding out this. You know, we do a lot of history talk, and a lot of times it's about Quincy, but this one kind of is about Quincy, but it's also about a lot going on in that time period. Of course, we're talking about the 1860 election for president. We know Lincoln and Douglas and all that was going on, but the election itself, Stephen Douglas was second in the popular vote, but he only won two states in the Electoral College. Can you name one of those states? That's the question. I'm not going to give you any clues, okay? But I will give you some hints, all right? So the first one is this. There were 33 states at the time, all right? And one of those states was a Confederate state.
Okay.
So there you go. You just have a total blank look on your face.
I'm doing some mental math. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
Well, you can think about it. Again, the question is this. Stephen Douglas, he was second in the popular vote, but only won two states in the Electoral College. Can you name one of those two states?
So do I get half correct if I get one state?
I'm going to give you a full correct if you get one, and then we're going to I'll buy you a steak dinner if you can figure both of them out.
Oh, boy.
Okay. Without cheating.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, so we'll have that answer coming up at the end of this episode. But it's time to, as mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we go from the mad Dr. McDowell to another doctor. But this one, instead of...
more of an honorary doctorate, actually. More reverend. Yeah. Reverend.
Okay, reverend's a good one. Yeah, so instead of hacking people up, though, he was writing books. We're going to talk about the guy we talk about in Folklore of Adams County. He's the author of that one. We're going to talk about Dr. Harry Hyatt, and that's coming up next here on Wild Quincy. Here's what you missed on the latest After Hours episode of Wild Quincy.
In a morbid prank, one student hid behind the shooting target when McDowell was getting ready to take aim and fire. So McDowell doesn't know this kid's behind the target. So McDowell fires, and the student jumps out from behind, pretending like the bullet hit him. And he like flails like to the ground like he's mortally wounded and pretends to collapse and die.
Well, the doctor's got to attend to him, right?
Nope. Allegedly, McDowell quickly hightailed it out of there, seeming to run in fear for his horrible crime. When students revealed the prank, McDowell was so ecstatic that he hadn't just killed a man that he hugged in the student over and over in great relief.
Our After Hours episodes are available exclusively for Patreon members by going to patreon.com/wildquincy. For just a couple dollars a month, not only will you double the amount of Wild Quincy episodes at your fingertips, but you'll also be supporting our efforts as we continue to dive into the wild and crazy history of our favorite town. Also, as a Patreon member, you can take part in our live events and Patreon-only outings, as well as having access to our regular episodes 2 days before they are released to the public. It's easy. Just head to patreon.com/wildquincy. That's Patreon, patreon.com/wildquincy, and become a wild thing today. Back here on Wild Quincy, and you know, we have such a wide variety of amazing guests that come on, and this is no different, as we are talking about another people episode and digging into a guy that we've talked about a lot, and we spent a couple of years now talking to him because we found this great book, and it all started from this book called Folklore from Adams County, Illinois. But now we get to find out about the man behind this book, and that is none other than Harry Middleton Hyatt. Of course, Harry no longer with us, but we found somebody that might know a little something about him, Travis, and I think if you want to, you can do the introduction.
Sure. No, absolutely. It was. It's surprising how different people's lives kind of cross paths in unexpected ways. And we decided to bring in one of these people that actually knew Harry. And unfortunately, that collection of people is kind of dwindling. But we're bringing, and we're more than happy to welcome back one of our most popular guests from previous episode, Chuck Schultz. Chuck, welcome back to Wild Quincy. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great, Travis. Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I'm a big Dr. Harry Middleton Hyatt guy because I met him when I was still a student. He was very close with my mom and my dad. My dad ended up being his attorney and probating his estate. And
oh, really?
That was very interesting because he had papers that went to Harvard. He had them sent to the British Museum. The Smithsonian took quite a bit of his work. But, of course, as you know, Travis, a lot of it is at Brenner Library at Quincy University.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's tee this up a little bit, Chuck. Who was Dr. Harry Middleton Hyatt? I mean, give us the 30,000 level foot.
Born and raised here in Quincy, his father, Samuel Hyatt, was our state senator back in the 1920s.
Is that right?
And Dr. Hyatt, very, very well educated, has PhD, but also an ordained Episcopal priest. And I can remember him sitting at the dining room table with my mom, sipping tea with his clerical garb on and white gloves, very proper gentleman. But he had been all over the world and he had waded into all sorts of situations and has quite a body of work. And we don't realize really locally how significant the folklore of Adams County. You think, well, is there folklore of Brown County or Hancock
right,
County? No.
Right.
This book, John Schleppenbach, who was an esteemed professor at Quincy University and who came to Quincy University because Dr. Hyatt had retired back to Quincy. That was the only reason he and his wife Barb came to Quincy was to be near Dr. Hyatt. Well, he has said there's no other book like this. There's no other collection like this in the country. And he said, really, globally, it's partly because of the volume and the tenacity. You know, his sister must have been really something because she collected a lot of this. But 16,000 entries. And because of our location on the Mississippi and in the 19th century and the way people were moving, you get this wide variety of folklore. You get a lot of African-American folklore. You know, after the Civil War, a lot of African-Americans in Northeast Missouri came across to Quincy to work in factories in Quincy. I have a great book called The Annotated Huckleberry Finn. You know, Ernest Hemingway famously said, the history of American literature begins and ends with one book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Wow.
Greatest book ever written, say, in America. So I could put it up against the Bible, but it's really good. But all those annotations, you know, when Jim is telling Huck how to get ready, you know, you got to go get rid of your warts at midnight in the cemetery with stump water or whatever. All of those go back to folklore of Adams County. They're all annotated by Dr. Hyatt by far. There are other annotations in there, but folklore of Adams County by far is the most prevalent. So it's really well known. And in addition to that African-American lore, of course, we have all this German.
Right.
And sure. So many, as you guys know, and I want to commend you for discovering the book and featuring it in your podcast. The Germans were obviously very superstitious. And even though Wisconsin claims, you know, the greatest German immigration, it's hard to beat Quincy and Adams County. It really is. I have a great relationship thanks to our sister city, and I have ancestors from near Hereford in North Rhine-Westphalia in Germany, and many thousands of people in Quincy do. And among my acquaintances is a linguistics professor from Bielefeld University who my dad was telling him how if you go up to Golden, you can still find people that would speak what he would call the Plattdeutsch, which they called the Low Dutch. Okay. And this professor who had studied all over the world, wherever Germans went, and particularly had studied for years in Wisconsin. And he said, well, that's not possible because that would be five generations. And it just doesn't last that long. That's not possible. So my dad took him up there and introduced him to a couple of folks that spoke the Low Dutch. And he recorded it. He went back to Germany, wrote an academic paper about it. But that's the extent, you know, of our German heritage here. It really, a lot of it, especially in Quincy, it would go back to John Wood. John Wood wanted Germans to come to Quincy. John Wood spoke German. John Wood's father, who was a doctor, all his medical journals are written in German. And by the way, John Wood's father, John was an extraordinary man. His father, Daniel, was doctor in the Revolutionary War and was with George Washington at Valley Forge.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize he was a doctor. I knew he was in the war, but interesting.
Yeah. So, and he's one of the few Revolutionary War soldiers buried in Adams County. There's a few, I think, up north of Ursa there. But he died in New York, but John Wood went to New York, dug him up, and brought him 1,000 miles over land and buried him in Woodland Cemetery. He's in the woods. You know, John Wood donated Woodland Cemetery to the city with a reversion, that a remainder that all of his descendants forever could be buried there. And they have been. And we're up to like John Wood the 7th, I believe. And I've been to a couple of those funerals of John Wood. We, when I was mayor, you know, the Woodland has a separate perpetual care corporation, but they also subsidized by the city because it was a city cemetery. I used to sign all the deeds to the cemetery plots there. And I was able to work it out with John Wood the 5th. To define, because it's in the middle of the cemetery, it couldn't be infinite, you know, it would run out of room there, but we worked it all out. Anyway, get back to the Germans. So you guys know in Quincy, that's the south side of town, the Calf Town is German.
Right, right.
Well, John Wood owned from 24th Street to the river, Maine to Harrison. So in other words, the entire south half
south
of
side.
Quincy.
Yeah.
And, often to, especially when he started constructing his mansion in 1835 and he wanted these skilled German craftsmen, he went down to St. Louis and he offered them plots of land. My own German ancestors that arrived in 1848, they bought their little plot at 9th and State from John Wood. So that's why Calf Town grew the way it was. And he was perfectly fine with all these German families keeping a cow in the backyard. And that's the, of course, the origin of Calf Town. So anyway, to get back to Dr. Hyatt, he had all this rich German tradition of superstitions, and he and his faithful sister documented 16,000 different pieces of folklore. So there really isn't anything like that anywhere in the world.
Yeah, it's amazing that you know that a book like this is put together. And as you were talking about that, you know, I was kind of reverting to today's world. I don't think you could come up with a book like this in today's world. Am I off? I'm thinking that this is I don't think you would have this folklore like what we do from back in that time. That I mean, we might be able to come up with like 300 or 400, but 16,000. I don't know.
Well, if it hadn't been for Dr. Hyatt, no, it would all be lost, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And now it'll be there forever. And then he had these other, you know, he was interested in the Millers of Kentucky, which are my own ancestors on my maternal my mother's father ancestors all came when they were disciples of Christ. Alexander Campbell, 1840s, coming up the Mississippi from Kentucky and then the Salt River to Shelby County, and those were the founders of Culver Stockton and so forth, and a lot of disciples of Christ still over there. But that's where Dr. Hyatt's ancestors were from, and he shared that interest with my mom on genealogy. So that's how really my mom and dad got to know him, even though they had already acquired years before his book on coastal Georgia, the hoodoo, voodoo, and witchcraft. And which, again, just an odd coincidence with my family. My folks had been going down to the to St. Simon's Island, but all those islands down there, Sapelo and Ocracoke, Cumberland, they're filled with the Gullah and the Geechee heritage of these West African slaves that were forced to come over there and maintain their own language, music, and a lot of superstition and folklore, which Dr. Hyatt, back in the 1920s, when, you know, it was hard to even get out to these islands by boat, and most people on the islands had never been on the mainland. So, you know, there's another area where my family and we've been going down to that area for years and years and years. It's really interesting. I had a chance to meet a woman on Sapelo Island called Cornelia Walker Bailey. And she wrote a book, which she signed for me, God, Dr. Buzzard, and the Bolito Man, all of this kind of stuff. And if you might remember, you know, in Savannah, there was a famous novel that was made into a movie with Kevin Spacey, The Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. If you go to Savannah, the standard history tour, they'll take you by that house. Well, that involved Dr. Bolito as well. The Bolito Man was well known for his voodoo, hoodoo, witchcraft, and putting on spells, and that had to do with that whole murder plot. So amazing stuff over there. And they're still trying, you know, to keep their own heritage and pass that on to another generation. And they've had help from national historians at the Smithsonian and so forth. But Dr. Hyatt, again, he was a pioneer in documenting all that way back when, and thank God he did. So, Travis, you're right. Folks really need to know that he was that significant. And I know you went over to Brenner Library years ago. Father Victor, who was the librarian at that time, took me up. You know, when they built Brenner Library back in the late 60s, thanks to Dr. and Mrs. Brenner, God bless them, the Franciscan asked for a special room to be built in there that's humidity control, temperature, secure, because they wanted to put all of the friars' history that they'd brought from Germany, which at that time was still over in Teutopolis. They wanted to have a place, permanent repository for all that, so it's all in there. But they got a lot of really cool stuff in there from Dr. Hyatt that he collected all over the world. He showed me these ancient, and I'm ancient, I mean like over 1,000-year-old Coptic text from Ethiopia, these early Christians, and they're carved into animal hides, and they're up there in Brenner Library. Thanks to Dr. Hyatt and the Quincy connection. Like I say, born and raised in Quincy, if you go down to Washington Park, walk up into the bandstand, and there's a plaque. It's all green now, copper plaque, and it commemorates Samuel Hyatt, Dr. Hyatt's father, who was this state senator back in the 20s. And the story I had always heard was he had a wooden leg, which was very convenient because he kept his flask in there. And you guys have done some prohibition stuff, I think. And, you know, the Adams County Historical Society at the History Museum at 4th and Main right now has an exhibit on Quincy in the 20s. But I know you've done some stuff on our wild and woolly days.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let me pepper in a few dates here real fast, just to kind of get some people some ideas on kind of what was happening with Dr. Hyatt and his whole history in Quincy. He was actually born in 1896. So we're talking a significant time. He was born in Quincy, Illinois, and you already kind of talked about his parentage a little bit. But what's interesting is he grew up around the 6th and Chestnut. He was born, I guess, on a house at 6th and Chestnut, and I guess the family moved to 6th and Cedar. And at that time in Quincy, 6th Street was the only road that was paved in town. Hmm. And because of that, he saw the whole world going by. You know, he would have the people selling fish going around door. They'd go around to the neighborhood and ring a big bell. And if you were interested, you'd go out and you'd buy some fish, or sometimes they'd sell it off the back of their truck. He'd see all the people. I mean, it was a huge, basically the highway. There'd be people bringing in cattle from out of town. And so he really got an interesting overview of Quincy. But what I found really interesting was really his conception, so to speak. His parents were well into their 40s. I think his mother was 42. He was kind of what they call an oops baby. They were not expecting him. And honestly, his mother didn't want anything to do with him. She honestly tried things to get rid of him. And this is coming from his own account of his life. As you mentioned in Brenner Library, there's so much information, including the year of his death. He had a secretary. Actually, there's at least 10 or 12 audio tapes front and back where he's literally just recounting his entire life story, and all that's transcribed. And so it was a little eye-opening. His three sisters were already well into their teenage years. He even mentions that, you know, I don't know to what extent his mother tried to, I don't want to say use the word abortion here, but I think she couldn't find a doctor, a reputable doctor at the time that would do that. And so I guess she doesn't go into a lot of color on what she did, but there was a lot of concerns from, I think, his grandfather that he was going to be born with issues because of some of the actions of his mother, strangely enough. And so you have this kid enter the world, and to kind of have that sense of being unwanted, he managed to really pave such a bright, colorful path. And it was a little bit surprising to me of the evolution of him from those kind of beginnings where you hear that as a kid, that could easily traumatize you, and you might not make much with your life. But he really excelled at being in the Episcopalian, being ordained.
Yeah, to be ordained and go through their seminary as well as become a PhD and then become a world-renowned author and researcher.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I found even more interesting is, as he was recounting this, and this was Henry, there's another side story we'll probably talk about on the Patreon side between him and his wife. His wife preferred to call him Henry instead of Harry. And you talked about Prohibition earlier. Strangely enough, he met his wife, Alma, in New York. Actually, it was at a party that she was hosting. And this party was in the middle of Prohibition, and she had all kinds of booze. And he was literally between two services at the Episcopalian church, and people were kind of pushing him to come to the party and meet this Alma. Well, he didn't know that she had been widowed about 10 months earlier. And this is actually a pretty big reason why Harry was able to do what he did with all writing all these things. See, her former husband was actually the man behind the Icy Hot thermos bottle. And he was worth millions. And she inherited a great deal of this and that amount
That's
of money.
That's interesting, Travis, because the publication says something like the Alma Hyatt Foundation.
Foundation, exactly. Yeah. They founded that. Her money was the bankroll for him being able to go to all these places to conduct research. And they actually, I laugh because she was very kind of a highfalutin lady and not necessarily one you took home to your mom. I think Harry's early history of not really caring too much to impress his mom, given the circumstances of his arrival into the world, he kind of saw her as being a little bit of a little dangerous almost in a way. And she was accustomed to a pretty high level of life. And so the idea of her coming back to Quincy was just not going to happen. And that's why they spent most of their time in New York. And actually, he went over to Oxford to get another degree, divinity-wise, and that's where they ended up marrying, which was, that would have been in 1924. They got married in Oxford. So she was not only a bankroll, but he truly loved her and just pined over her. And there's so many letters and letters where these, you know, little fun little conversations, I believe when they first met at that party I spoke of, she was being very coy and very challenging to him, went up to him and said, "So you're a I forget what they call the Episcopalian, a priest or a pastor or a father."
Yeah, priest.
And he's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Yeah." She's like, "Well, I don't care much about church. I don't go to church." And so he's just like, "Wow, okay." And so he's pretty quick on his feet, and he's kind of recounting this years later. He's like, "You know, I thought it would be in my best interest to say something kind of clever." And so I said, "Well, that's okay. I'm not here to convert you." And, you know, they had this fun, like, little Humphrey Bogart, you know, back and forth, you know. And it's so funny to hear him describing this in his own letters, kind of recounting her memory. And
I can see where he would have thought she probably would have shaken things up in Quincy quite a bit.
I think she would
somebody have. Or New York, you know. And he himself, as you guys know, he's writing stuff like voodoo, hoodoo, witchcraft, and the coastal islands there. I mentioned to Travis, Chris, that my brother and I, as kids, we attacked those volumes because there was all kinds of sexy stuff in there. And, you know, a lot of these potions and a lot of fertility rites, and many of them relate to, you know, male and female. And, you know, when you're 10 years old or whatever, any reference there too, you want to see if you can figure it all out. But, yeah, people in Quincy, they may have known that he had this intellectual pursuit, but I'm sure they didn't know what he was writing about, because some of it, even today, is pretty graphic.
Right. Yeah. And what I found most interesting about his legacy, so to speak, Chuck, is he is well-known within certain circles. And those are the people that still practice this today. I mean, this isn't just a lost art. Down in the South and in other parts of the country, there are still people that very much consider themselves all the nomenclature, but a high priestess of hoodoo. And this is where Hyatt's works are at now. They're on the bookshelf because he didn't just tell stories about these, you know, the witchcraft, the root work, the conjuration. This is an instruction manual for some certain spells. I mean, he has it all out there.
And it's like it's a not just illusions. Really thick volumes. I mean, it's
Yeah.
It really amounts to quite a bit. You know, I went to a law school in Georgia, and so I lived there for 3 years. And downtown Macon, Georgia, there was a place that said magic shop. Well, I, you know, amateur, try to do a few tricks or whatever. So go in there. And there were a few in the front. When you went into the back, that's where you could get the potions. You could get the lucky number stuff. Because in those days, you know, especially in the African-American community, the policy wheel was the numbers racket. And if you wanted to win, you know, you had to get the lucky number. And there were different ways do that and burn candles, but there were also things that you could put on other people. Now, you know, that's been almost 50 years ago, but I think you're absolutely right, Travis. That culture, certainly I could take you onto some of those coastal islands, in the, you know, South Carolina, Georgia, that these folks, you know, there's a great movie, I believe it's called, it's either the novel was The Water is Wide, and I think the movie is called Conrec, but the guy that wrote Prince of Tides, Pat Conroy, wrote Lords of Discipline, very successful author. Mm-hmm. When he got out of college, his first job was to teach on Dufusky Island. It's in a little black one-room schoolhouse. They'd had this black lady teaching them, for been there for decades. So he's right out of college, first day, he starts asking them questions. They never heard of Willie Mays. This is back in the 60s. They didn't know who the president was. They'd never been to the mainland. They lived on an island, but they couldn't swim. And it's a great movie. And at the end, he takes them to the mainland and so forth and whatever. John Voight plays the main character. And actually filmed on St. Simon's, and that little one-room schoolhouse is still there. But anyway, I think even today, there are enough isolated areas out there where they're still preserving this culture. And like I said, with the Germans, you know, there's places around way out there in Adams County where they can still speak the Low Dutch.
Is that, yeah, I can see that. Wow. I can see that.
So Chuck, let me ask you. You said that your family spent some time with him, and it sounded like you were pretty young when that was happening. But is there any memories you have personally with him? Did you have guys dinners together? Is there anything that sticks out that you remember?
The thing that I can remember is my mom. When he moved back to Quincy, he rented a nice apartment, and he turned that into his office. So Mrs. Fogg,
it was in the four-court apartments right there on State Street.
Just off of State Street there on 30th and State. And so I went over, my mom was over there, and I went over to pick her up, so I got to go in. And just voluminous, you know, you could just imagine floor-to-ceiling papers, records, all kinds of stuff, you know. But he was a well-organized guy, and like I say, he was a rigorous academic. But it's interesting, your research, Travis, as to how he was able to travel the world and do all of that.
Yeah.
It's helpful.
I don't think he could have done as much as he did without kind of having that source of funding. And, you know, he wasn't just utilizing her for her funds. It was truly like a love story for the ages. I mean, I truly believe he was trying to put together another book. At least another book. There was going to be a sixth volume to the folk, or not folklore, but the hoodoo. Right now, there were five volumes. He was working on a sixth when he died, and that was going to be an index of everything. Because unfortunately, right now, it's kind of all over the place, and the whole vision, because he originally, it would have been in the... let me get this right here. I don't want to get in 1970. He published the first two volumes of Hoodoo, Conjuration, Witchcraft, and Root Work. And at the time, he kind of thought it was going to be the complete set, the two volumes. But over the next several years, he released three more to get up to five. And then, as I mentioned, you know, he was going to work in that six, which really helped tie everything together a little bit. But unfortunately, he passed.
That if you could find a first edition, they're very valuable.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, Chris, I mean, we were looking not just on the hoodoo, but on Folklore of Adams County alone. I think there were only 100 things published or printed of hoodoo. And you're talking like $5,000, $8,000.
No, like $50,000.
Yeah,
Full set, the one we could find on eBay, I think it was eBay right now, or maybe it was Amazon, was going for like $57,000, I think.
That is incredible.
Tremendous.
So like you say, even though most of us around here really aren't that familiar, there are people that know all about Dr. Hyatt.
If you, I did a couple of YouTube searches, because when I do research, I try to go down every conceivable path. You never know who might have a story about him. And the most stuff I found on YouTube was actually kind of instructional for like hoodoo practice, and they're referencing his work. And this is modern day people, you know, who still reference these works. And I mean, like you said, I mean, certain circles, he's not really that well known, but in others, he's definitely a figurehead. And it's interesting just to, I have this visual of, there's lots of photos like you referenced in his archive there at Brenner Library. And there's so many photos of him actually. Because when he did research, and this is a whole nother topic I wanted to hit on. I mean, he wasn't writing letters or making phone calls in a lot of cases. In most of the cases, he was going down. He went to Alabama. He went to Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, feet on the ground, going into maybe the more unsavory neighborhoods to have conversations with the people who practiced, to the point where a lot of the police forces in these areas got super suspicious and thought he might be like a drug lord or something. And so in a couple instances, he had to get special permission from the law to be in these places. And it's just like, you see this really conventional white guy in his 70s, you know, in his 60s and 70s, in his full, you know, Episcopalian getup, you know, just wandering in like the ghettos of Tennessee.
Yeah, I recall he even had a hat.
Okay, yeah. And it's such a juxtaposition of, you know, Because when he did a lot of his research, I guess a lot of his research was done in 1938 and 1940. So there was about between 1940 and 1970 where he first released the hoodoo work. I mean, so he's down there 10 years doing all this legwork, recording to like cylinders. The audio tape wasn't around yet. And he actually lost a lot of work when his equipment failed. Mm. But it's just such a bizarre visual, you know, to picture this, you know, this guy wandering through all these neighborhoods and just getting blown away and by all this, you know, this straight information straight from the source when it came to all these spells and
you know, like I say, hoodoo. Travis, a lot of it was kind of ribald, you know. It was really for a prim and proper Episcopal priest, They're talking about these fertility rites and all kinds.
Exactly.
Right.
But that was the contract.
Seems so strange.
He soaked it up and passed it on. We would have lost all that.
Yeah, and he didn't edit it. I mean, he wasn't forming a narrative, and I think that really shines through on both the folklore book and the limited amount from Hoodoo that I've referenced. Is he wasn't trying to paint a picture one way or the other. When he would interview these people, they would be suspicious about what's this white guy want to know about all this stuff, right? And he would just say, I'm just researching hoodoo. And he kept it completely open, and he really didn't put a lot of narrative. And Chris, you can probably attest to this as you go through every episode and just kind of grab a handful of sayings. It's just, you know, boom, that's what was said. And yeah. There's not a lot of editorial comments really provided, which is interesting. It kind of speaks to the value of his research and just not trying to dilute or make a narrative out of it. I think that's
it's
huge.
Not judgmental at all. It's just very objective.
Yeah, there's multiple times where you would look through the history or the folklore book where he goes and just says, like, you'll have one person that, I don't know, says something random, like, you know, and then the very next one is like absolutely against, like, you know, it's good luck to have a cow walk in front of you. And then the next one is it's bad luck to have a cow walk in front of you. Like he wouldn't differentiate between, okay, which one sounds more legitimate. They were all in there. So there is, and Chuck, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, in the book, in the versions that I have, or the version, I actually have multiple versions now, but there are numbers missing in the book. I don't know if you're aware of this or not.
No, I wasn't.
Yes, there's a few sections where there's maybe like 200 or something, or maybe 100 of them that are missing, and then there's every once in a while of a number that's skipped, which you would expect to happen with 16,000 of them in there. But yeah, there's sections, and I don't know if it's just from bad like transcribing and putting them into a different version, or if maybe those numbers missed a time or something along those lines.
Or even there were got two censored somehow if they were just too hot to handle.
Exactly.
You know, there were two actual releases of that I found during my research. The first one took place, the original was in 1935. And then I think it was sometime, I don't have the exact date, but sometime in the 70s, kind of a second version was released, which I'd be really curious to compare the two together and see what was omitted and kind of see if there's any conclusions you can draw from that. But that is interesting. Absolutely, Chris.
So we have obviously the folklore, we have the hoodoo. Chuck, you mentioned the Millers. I guess I want to wrap my head around this one a little bit more. It was kind of an interesting, it's the Millers of Millertown or something along those lines.
Millersburg, Kentucky. Yeah, the Millers of Millersburg, Kentucky. Uh-huh. So that was released in 1926. It was his first work, I believe.
Okay, so between two of you guys, I'm guessing you could answer this question for me, is that I'm guessing that it had the local ties. Is that going back to, as you mentioned, the Culver Stockton stuff?
Right.
Is that
so
where that...
Back, Alexander Campbell was one of the founders of the Disciples of Christ, and it all happened around Nicholas County, Kentucky, town of Carlisle, Kentucky, close by there. And so many of those folks, and again, as I said, you know, they call that the Second Great Awakening. There was a lot of religious movement, especially out where we were on the frontier at the time. And those folks generally... they came up the Mississippi to the Salt River and populated throughout Northeast Missouri. And that would be my grandfather Wright's ancestors. We still have some furniture. We even have a plant that's been passed through the family from the 1840s when they got hit. He was in the little town of Leonard, Missouri. But yeah, Disciples of Christ founded Culver Stockton in 1853, the first coeducational institution of higher learning west of the Mississippi. They were very enlightened folks. And recently, Scott Geltner, who's a professor of history at Culver, did a program on the founding of Culver, the Founders' Day. And I did not realize that many, many prominent people attended. Orville Browning from Quincy, who was Quincy's greatest lawyer and served in the United States Senate, was Secretary of Interior under Andrew Johnson. Lewis Cass was there. Lewis Cass was the governor of Michigan, but like Cass County, Illinois, Beardstown, Virginia is named for Lewis Cass. He ran for president, but a lot of people ran for president back in the 1840s, including Dr. Eales from Quincy, our abolitionist Underground Railroad. He ran, and Joseph Smith ran.
Really?
You know, it was easier to put your name out there, but and I think later on, I think C.A. Mormon, who was the founder of Mormon Manufacturing in Quincy, actually ran for president, I believe, in the late 19th century. And then in our lifetime, Maury Taylor from Titan Wheel. I can't remember exactly what year that was. I think I was mayor, though.
90s. I want to feel like it was like 96.
Yeah. 96 was probably it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, that, you know, you just got up an idea. Maybe that might be an episode of its own of presidential candidates from Quincy. I've never thought we had that many.
You know, we were trying to think the other day because we're for the bicentennial of Quincy and Adams County, which will be next year, 2025. There were five presidents that visited Quincy as presidents, official presidential visits. But there are a lot of other presidents that have come through Quincy, mostly before they were president, right?
Right.
We have one. Trump came after he's president. But, you know, starting with Lincoln, Lincoln came here to court. He made a famous speech in 1854, the debate in 1858. Grant crossed the Mississippi at Quincy to quell the uprising from those rebels in northeast Missouri. That was his first campaign. And a lot of others in my lifetime, JFK was here. You know, he got an honorary degree from Quincy College and he spoke at the Lincoln Douglas. Nixon was here as vice president. Johnson was here as vice president. Reagan was here before he was elected. And let's see, Carter came on the Delta Queen, but he didn't. I don't know if we can count that. It stopped at the Lock and Dam. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, the heart was in the right place there. But the five that actually came are Rutherford B. Hayes, who spoke at the original Tremont Hotel. So that's where WGEM is now. McKinley had a great presidential visit, 12,000 people in Washington Park. And he brought the cabinet with him, which included John Hay, his Secretary of State. Born and raised in Warsaw, well, not born in Warsaw, but raised in Warsaw, educated in Pittsfield and then Springfield. And of course, what an amazing person. One of the most important people ever to come out of Western Illinois. Many people would say he was the greatest diplomat in American history. But as you guys know, you know, he started out with Lincoln. He was Lincoln's secretary. Right. Lincoln would walk into his bedroom at 3 a.m. because Lincoln was an insomniac and, you know, read Shakespeare to him. But you know, he also, like Dr. Hyatt, had the wisdom to marry an extremely wealthy person. I think she was the daughter of the second richest man in America. And John Hay, who then went on to be a great success with literature, and then eventually, you know, became this diplomat. In those days, like the top post is ambassador to the court of St. James to be in London. Well, to do that, you have to put on the dog equal to the czar's ambassador from Russia and to the, you know, to the German Kaiser and whatever. And he didn't get paid for that, but he had the money. So he had the whole Downton Abbey set up while he was in London.
Wow.
That was his favorite job ever. But he got called back to be Secretary of State. And then, of course, McKinley dies. Teddy Roosevelt becomes president. And he was, John Hay was the speak softly, and Teddy Roosevelt was carry the big stick. And John Hay managed to do the Boxer Rebellion and the Panama Canal. And brilliant guy, spoke about five languages. And spoke that day in Washington Park when McKinley was here. So, yeah, we should do something with John Hay for sure. Yeah. There's a public use area over by Hannibal, and that's about it.
Huh.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Real giant. Huh. Real giant. So, anyway, yeah, we're going to do something to commemorate those presidential visits and then maybe try to list all the rest of the men that have served as president that have come through Quincy.
That's that would be kind of neat. Yeah, I remember we've talked about that. There was one that came in on a train, and then he made like two stops, and then he stayed at somebody's house, but he didn't want to be. It was like he really wasn't there to like be president or something. He was just there visiting somebody. I don't remember which one that was. I don't know if it was McKinney or
you know, Teddy Roosevelt when he came back before Teddy Roosevelt. You really didn't campaign. You know, Lincoln. There's always a Quincy connection, right? He would receive visitors, the party officials from around the country. Well, he couldn't do it in this little second floor cramped law office that he shared with William Herndon. So John Wood, his great friend and supporter, said, why don't you use my office in the Capitol? John Wood was governor in 1860. He never went to Springfield. He didn't want to be governor. He didn't want to go to Springfield. And, you can go there today when you tour the old state capitol, and I'll show you the governor's office where Lincoln conducted the 1860 campaign. And he did that thanks to John Wood. So really, you know, that was the old front porch campaigns until Teddy came along, and he campaigned like they do today, just boom, boom, boom. So he was here, I believe, for less than 1 hour. He pulls into the train station, like 2nd and Oak. They have a big parade over to the courthouse. We had the big, cool courthouse in those days. This is 1903, you know, the Gothic dome.
Right.
And before 1945, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Before the tornado. So the people were on the courthouse lawn. He was over on Vermont Street speaking to them. He stood on two chairs, 1 foot on each chair, spoke for 11 minutes, had a parade back to the train station and on to Galesburg or wherever.
Add it down to a science, sounds like.
So back in 2000, when President Clinton decided to come to Quincy the day after his last State of the Union address, happened to be on Air Force One at the time. So I'm in the middle section, which I would describe as like a really nice first class section. But I'm back there with the congressional delegation, and this young Air Force officer comes in and he says, Mayor Schultz, please follow me. And I get to go up to the forward cabin because Clinton wants to know about Quincy before he gets there. And the first question he asked me was, when was the last time a sitting president came to Quincy? And I was ready for him. I said, Teddy Roosevelt. And he said, Roosevelt, he's my favorite president. He said, you got to read this book. It's called River of Doubt by Candace Millard. And I did read it, and it's great. It's about after Roosevelt was president, he went down this uncharted tributary of the Amazon. I've read all her books. They're tremendous.
Yeah, him and his son Kermit, I think, went down, and he almost Kermit died down there, didn't he? Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, Travis and the Pope almost died, and other people did die.
Yeah, that's a heck of a story.
Oh, my gosh. So anyway, Clinton wants to know the history of Quincy, and I said, okay, hey, I think you're asking the right guy here. Sit back. And I started with John Quincy Adams, our namesake for the city and the county, and the great abolitionist. It went right into City of Refuge and Underground Railroad and sheltering the Mormons and the Potawatomis, and he got an earful from me.
Made it count. There you go.
Well, you don't get too many opportunities like that.
Exactly.
No, you don't. Exactly. Well, you know, Dr. Hyatt was an amazing author in his own right. And, you know, I think you hit it real well, Chuck, when you said, you know, we wouldn't have what we have here if it wasn't for him, what he did in his work. And, you know, final thoughts before we kind of wrap things up, Chuck, you know, what do you think about Dr. Hyatt and his time in Quincy?
Well, we're really fortunate. And I really want to commend you guys for keeping the memory alive there, because there, like I say, there's only a few of us that would know. And now with these podcasts, you know, that's memorialized. And you know, I'm a fan of you guys. I listen. I do. When I get on my treadmill, I'm looking for a podcast. I enjoyed the cemeteries.
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, my son, daughter-in-law, and three of my granddaughters live where that first Catholic cemetery was, you know, from on Main.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Get the Irish, and then I think the Germans first, and then the Irish. And you guys, have you told that story of Father McGurr? You know, when they went to extend Hampshire Street, Hampshire Street ended at 18th. And to extend it, you would have been getting in. They had moved. The Irish had gone to St. Peter's at 33rd and Broadway. The Germans had been moved to St. Boniface, but there were still graves there. And I think some of them were Civil War veterans. And so when the day they were out there to bust it open with their pickaxes and shovels and extend Hampshire Street east from 18th, Father Peter McGurr, now that's the same man who was the great mentor to Father Tolton. He was pastor of St. Peter's. He stood there and said, "You're not coming through." And he had a confrontation with the mayor. They sent out the mayor, and he said, "We're going to extend this street." And he said, "No, you're not. Not until all these bodies have been reburied." And it took about a month, but eventually the council voted city money to relocate these grave sites, and then Hampshire Street was extended. And I would note that particular mayor did not get reelected.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, I don't think he made the cut next time around.
This Father McGurr was something else. So there's a guy that is trying to do a movie on the life of Father Tolton, from slave to priest. You know, it would be a great movie. Here's Martha Jane Tolton rowing across the river to freedom, and they're being shot at by these Confederates. So anyway, I've met with the guy. He's got like a little 10-minute video pitch. He's trying to get investors and so forth. But one of the people that's promoting it is Kevin James, who, you know,
really?
The actor Kevin James, because he wants to play Father Peter McGurr.
Huh. I guess that'd be fun.
Wouldn't it?
That would be something.
That'd be neat.
You know, Father Tolton, the whole story, it's gotten all the way to Hollywood, apparently.
Wow.
Well, that's awesome. You know, the trajectory he's on won't be long for us. It's Saint Tolton, it seems like. So it might come into effect.
Well, I think that we might hear something in the next year about the next step would be beatification, which would be in Chicago. Bishop Perry tells me probably at the United Center would be a big deal. And that's after they certify the first miracle of intercession. And after Father Tolton was declared venerable by Pope Francis, now they consider the miracles. And there's a lot that have been submitted. And there's one that occurred in Quincy that, you know, I feel confident will get certified. The way you judge that is no medical explanation. And they have this young man who was in a coma, who came out of the coma as they prayed for Father Tolton to intercede. So, but there's a lot of them that have been submitted from all over the country. It's one of those things, like when you grew up in Quincy, and I grew up at St. Peter's Parish, so I knew about Father Tolton, but I didn't think anybody outside of Quincy had ever heard of him.
Right.
And I realize now that there are over 3 million African-American Catholics in America that revere Father Tolton. They know all about him. There's Father Tolton societies. It's quite a thing, and it would be quite a thing if he's canonized, and probably, hopefully, if we can save St. Boniface Church, that would become his shrine, and he would be exhumed, and his remains would be then at St. Boniface, and people would come from all over.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Hey, so we got to talk about this real quick, since we're on the subject. You brought up St. Peter's a couple times. I want to get your thoughts real quick. Do you feel that there are still people that are buried in
Madison Park? Absolutely. Yes. Definitely. Okay. When they were relocated, most of them had been, our original cemetery was where the courthouse is now. And as we know, they discovered remains there. I think it was called Jefferson Cemetery. So when they moved out to Madison, And that's also where Charlie, the fugitive slave that Dr. Reels was bringing out to the Mission Institute, he jumped out there. He escaped by running through that cemetery. Unfortunately, he was later recaptured. But anyway, yeah, a lot of people were never moved, including the Latter-day Saints that died that winter of 38 and 39. And that includes Samuel Young, father of Brigham Young. So there's a marker on the Main Street side, about halfway down the park there, that was put there by a young man. It was an Eagle Scout project. And it says, you know, Samuel Young is buried. We don't know where. I think from what I've heard over the years that the southeast corner, kind of where the tennis courts are, that's where you would probably find them. But, you know, Madison Park's a very interesting park. T.E. Musselman made sure that there were 100 different varieties of trees were planted. And he lived right across the street there. And, of course, he was a famous ornithologist and really a world-renowned guy that he made. His deal was Jim City Business College, as I recall. Jim City Business College was at 7th in Hampshire, and it was about a 7- or 8-story building, I think, filled with these stand-up desks. That's where you'd learn to be a clerk or a scrivener, you know, keep the account books and that sort of thing. That was the business college, and they had other things like their gyms. But anyway, T.E. Musselman was a very interesting guy. We might have to look into him at some point.
He's on my short list because of him pretty much single-handedly saving the bluebird in his activities.
Yes, he put up
quite a story there too.
And you see those, if you drive these county roads, you'll see those little boxes that are made, they put them on bench posts off.
Well, it's, you know, the funny thing about, you mentioned about the park, about with all the trees, and that's, we actually used to, when I was in high school, I was on a forestry team, so you had to learn different trees and stuff. We would spend a lot of time in Madison Park just going over all those trees and learning all those trees in there. And so it was so unfortunate when that storm came it really changed the whole landscape of that place.
It really did. It,
well, there's still a lot of the little tags on the trees with the numbers that it sounds like Musselman had a hand in, and the Boy Scouts had a hand in.
You guys are too young to know that. In Madison Park, there was a wading pool with a fountain right in the middle of the park.
Oh, is that right?
There was one at Reservoir Park that was bigger that had two fountains, and I think you could still see kind of on the north end of Reservoir Park, like, maybe west of the
behind the fire station.
Still kind of shape there of where. See, I think back in the 50s when polio was such a great fear, they somehow thought that if you were in those wading pools or something, that somehow could be communicable. I don't know, but that's when they shut them down. But years ago, like the one at Madison Park, all the nannies would bring their babies up in the baby buggies and park them in a circle around that fountain and let the kids play in the fountain. And then all the nannies and nurses would, get their little exchange of information going there, a little social circle.
Right, nanny there, talk Madison time. Park.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Something that I've always been curious about, what your thoughts were about Madison Park and if there were still bodies. And, you know, my biggest question I always had, and we've talked about this a little bit off the air, but I don't know how much we want to dig into it, but we have a few minutes here, but I'm surprised, and maybe there's a reason, I'm sure there's a reason that there hasn't been a concerted effort to possibly locate the bodies. Has there ever been any talk that you've ever heard about of going that route? Or are we just kind of knowing that they're there and just kind of leaving it as it is?
I have not heard anyone interested in pursuing that, but I think we could. You know, that is what they ended up doing at the courthouse. And I know over at Brush, where Father Tolton was baptized, the little chapel over there, they have a graveyard for the parishioners, and then they had a graveyard for the slaves. And originally those were not marked, but they were able to locate them all. And there are nice markers for them there, and they take care of it. I think there was an African-American Boy Scout troop from St. Louis that helped do that. And they told me one of the ways, you know, nowadays I think they have that ground penetrating radar, right?
Yeah.
But when they first identified the slave graves over at Brush Creek, they witched for them.
Oh, and wow.
Dowsing rods?
Divining.
Really?
The guy that did it, he told, I met him over there, and he said, yeah, he wouldn't believe, I didn't believe it either. And he said he was holding these two rods. Instead of putting his hands on them, he had like two Coke bottles, and his hands were on the bottles and the rods were in the bottle so that they didn't make any contact with them. And he said it worked. So I don't know.
That's wow.
Wow. That's a different way of doing it.
Yeah.
Well, if you see Chris and I wandering around Madison Park with our rods, you'll know what we're up to.
Absolutely. Yeah. But no, we probably should.
I mean, and you brought up a good point. And technology in just the past 10 years alone has really advanced the point. And something Travis I talked about recently was that, you know, I'm surprised there hasn't been some sort of effort to locate some of those, especially with who is potentially in that area that's like kind of unmarked graves, you know.
There may be a Google search of how much is ground penetrating radar cost in one of our computers.
There you go. Yeah. Well, it's a great
I want to find Bingo at the villa too while I'm at it.
I grew up around Madison Park, so lots of good memories there. When I was a kid at St. Peter's, all the recess was in the park. So, you know, like fifth grade was in one playground, and then sixth grade was a softball field or whatever. Nowadays, they stay on their own property there, but it's still nice to have that park.
Well, I know we got up on a fun little tangent there, but let me do a bookend here real quick on Hyatt. And I talked to you a little bit about this, Chuck, on a phone call we had, and I'm curious to kind of get your thoughts again. Hyatt seemed like he always had one foot in the traditional and one foot maybe a little bit in the occult. And I can't help but wonder, do you think that a character like Hyatt could exist in today's kind of cultural political climate of, you know, by day he's, you know, doing his services, and by night he's in the ghettos of Tennessee, you know, talking about witchcraft and black cat bones and mojos? I mean, how rare do you think Hyatt was of a creature of his time, or do you think it could be more of people like him today?
Well, I think there might be more today, or certainly maybe he would be of greater renown today just because of the way you described him and that whole dichotomy. But I think it worked to his advantage. But I really, at least as far as I ever saw him, he was the most prim, proper, upright, just what you would think for an Episcopal priest. And yet he was right down there hearing about the some of that stuff is really appeals to your prurient interest. But, you know, he did it kind of in a documentary way and pretty clinical about the whole thing. And like you say, you know, he never made judgments. He just wrote it down.
Yeah.
This is what they do. This is how they do it.
And a real quick pitch, if, you know, to your point and some of the things I alluded to, the archive of Hyatt is huge. It's massive. There's at least, 12, 15 banker's boxes, and that's probably a conservative guess, full of writings and letters and collections. I mean, it takes up, I want to say, 3.5 filing cabinets, just huge shelves. And I was there for 4 hours, and I felt like I barely scratched the surface. However, there are the 10 audio tapes of him, and can you imagine a podcast that's like a reliving of Hyatt in his own words? If you digitize those. So I don't know. I'm not saying I'm volunteering for that job, but that would be interesting.
Thank God for Quincy University and
absolutely
have it. And that opportunity is there. And who knows, there may be some students out there right now. You know, Father Phil Habing is another great Quincy University professor, friar. And he was also very much into folklore. Yeah, he wrote that book, and you guys have got that book, The Wildcat Whistle.
Right in front of me.
Right there. Tells the story of the Sny Island Drainage District. And there's some other whoppers in there, mainly river tales, right? But partly folklore and partly stuff that actually happened.
We may be visiting that in the future. I've got some ideas involving river monsters and kind of river culture, and that was a huge inspiration. So again,
well, I think there's the pictures in there, aren't there? Like a 6 foot fish or bigger.
Crazy shot. Yeah, there's crazy stories in there. Absolutely. It's fun. Well, Chuck, thanks so much for coming on Wild Quincy, sharing your recollection. It's like I said, unfortunately, it's more and more rare to talk to somebody who didn't just hear about, Harry Hyatt, but actually knew him in some capacity. And we can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing all the wealth of information that you possess.
Thank you guys for what you're doing. And I hear from people all the time that are so interested in these stories. And, you guys have that digital archive with the Harold Wiggs. So what a resource to mine.
Huge.
What was the story you did on the Starship thing where everybody in town witnessed that?
The airship.
It goes right up Main Street. Good grief.
Yeah. Wild stories just waiting to be found.
Firefighters as well.
I want more people going in there and doing podcasts. I want some competition. I want some more. Let's drive it up. A little healthy competition here.
That's right. So, yeah.
Well, I will see what I can do in terms of, but again, I love listening to you. And you mentioned, who was the other? Oh, at the airport, Now, I don't think Steven Spielberg's coming back because Cape Catshaw had the relative at Good Sam who's no longer there. But if you're at 36 and Broadway and the guy next to you looks like John Travolta, it could be.
It could be. You never know.
I ran it. Dan Isaacson from Quincy has been his personal trainer forever. And I ran into Mrs. Isaacson one day and I said, oh, how you doing? She said, let me show you this picture. And it was John Travolta and her. And they were, and I said, oh, did you go out to visit Dan in Hollywood? No, that's at my house here in Quincy.
That's awesome.
Because, he's quite a pilot. And we have mentioned before, if you're going from coast to coast, Quincy's a good place to set down. Mm-hmm. You got a great FBO, get refueled, got a restaurant out there, and so forth. So it's it would surprise you sometimes the kind of aircraft that come in and out of Quincy on the private aviation side, and sometimes they get a car and they come into town, and so who knows, it might be Jimmy Fallon that's taking shape, or
that's right
John Travolta cruising down Broadway.
You never know who you'll see or what you'll hear. It's a fun time.
Good stuff. Well, keep up the great work, man.
Well, thank you very much, and Chuck, we definitely do appreciate it. And that has been a look at Dr. Harry Middleton Hyatt. We'll be back with more after this on Wild Quincy.
Seasoned to bring out all the good meat flavor.
Everyone would be in love with me.
Next week, you handle just the refreshments, Freddy.
Man, that you talk about songs that just stick into your head as soon as you hear it. I think that may be one of them, Travis. Am I wrong?
It just gets better with age, like a fine wine. Yeah.
Maybe not so much for a hot dog, but
Hi Chris. I got a question for you, Chris.
Uh-huh.
If you were a hot dog, would you eat yourself? I sure would. They're delicious.
A little nod to SNL there. Yeah.
Yeah, that was some great Harry Carey there.
Thank you. What do you think? I mean, is there anything better than like a hot dog on the grill? You'd run to the grill, do you always throw a pack of hot dogs on
there? No, I wish I did, but I don't.
Oh, come on. Do you? It doesn't seem right to grill something and not just put a 6-12 pack, little double pack of Oscar Mayer on there.
There's five or six in it. I think it's five, six.
Yeah. My kids love hot dogs on the grill, so I know they're going to get eaten.
You can't go wrong there. Yeah, hot dogs on a stick are even better.
Those aren't bad. Those aren't bad.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Oscar Mayer, of course, is well known. I find this funny because the guy that made it was actually, he was from Germany, of course. We're talking about, you know, all the Germans in the Quincy area. He's, of course, a German as well. His name was Oscar F. Mayer. So they got me to think of Travis, like, how would you like to have a name of a multi-million dollar company that's been around for 100 years be your name? Wouldn't that be weird?
That would be weird. That would be weird. He probably, that's the same thing with Nathan's hot dogs, actually.
Really? Is his name Nathan?
Yeah, he was actually a Jewish immigrant from Poland, Nathan Handwerker. Yeah, 1915. He was one of those responsible for popularizing the hot dog. But I think he got a little more in your barrel on Oscar Mayer, I'm guessing, don't you?
Yeah, I do. He actually, they got real popular at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Of course, Oscar Mayer was living in Chicago, actually worked in a meat market in Detroit, then later in Chicago. And that's kind of where Oscar Mayer got its start at, is in the Chicago area. And then the World's Fair really got it taken off in that time. Yeah. We've all seen it. But of course, the trademark still around today is none other than the Wienermobile. You just saw it recently.
I did. It was made a trip to both the Hy-Vee locations in Quincy. I was a little bummed because I missed it at Harrison, but then the next day we ended up at the Broadway location, and by gosh, the Wienermobile was there. The kids got to see inside, and they got the prized weenie whistle that they still distribute.
Yes. Does it sound like a whistle, or does it sound?
It sounds just like the commercial, we just heard. Yeah, it's the same little whistle. Yep.
That's cool.
Little plastic whistle.
That thing's been around for, I just looked it up, that Oscar Mayer Wienermobile has been around for 80 years. It started touring 80 years ago.
You know, it's always a joy. It feels randomly throughout my life, I've had encounters with the Wienermobile. One day I was, I don't know what we were doing. We were going on some family road trip over in Missouri, and I think there was a factory over there. And sure enough, there was two Wienermobiles parked at the factory.
I was just wondering if there was more than one.
Oh yeah, it's there's several rolling out there. Boy, it seems like I had an alternate idea for the name of that vehicle the other day. My wife and I were talking about it, but I can't remember for the life of me what it was.
Was it PG worthy?
You know, that's why I hesitate to speculate. But you got some options there.
Yeah, exactly. So, but anyway, Oscar Mayer. Of course, they have the baloney too. You know, the my baloney has a first name. So that's even a more like memorable song than
they are knocking it out of the park with jingles.
Yeah,
Chris.
Jingles, man. Whoever their marketing people were, they knew what the hell they were doing.
Absolutely. I got to tell you, you mentioned this, and I think we should talk about it for a second. They really landed hard on the real meat.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they said it like seven times in the matter of like 15 seconds. I don't know if there was an issue or what.
Working in marketing, you don't just happen to say that five times. That is a targeted message. And I mean, you know, hot dogs have a bad reputation for what's in them.
Yeah.
And I really got a chuckle when they said, made of meat. Good meat. You know, not that nasty meat where we all really kind of know what's going on with the hot dogs. But
it's a meat.
The good meat.
It's a man's meat. Yeah, they nail it like seven times in a matter of like 15 seconds. It's insane. So
I love a hot dog.
Yeah, I love it's good stuff. Yeah, you can't go wrong with that.
You ever had a New York hot dog like out of the cart?
No.
Yeah, once I did that. It was delicious.
Good.
It was amazing. Yeah, that. Wonder what to do with all that hot dog water at the end of the day.
Dump it out in the river. It's a hot dog river.
Dump it down to the rats who like come upon it and ugh. Good hot dog. Not sure what happens afterwards.
Yes. I don't know how to transfer to the next thing. So I'm just going to say...
Well, you better, because I can go 20 minutes on hot dogs.
Let's bring out the golden pipes.
And now, it's time for Words of Wisdom from Adams County.
All right, of course, this episode is none other about the guy who made this book, this huge book that's called Folklore of Adams County, coming from Harry Middleton Hyatt.
Isn't that fun? Everybody's got a peek behind the curtain. They know a little bit about the man now. So it's no longer this shadowy figure that we just reference in passing,
Chris. We just thought it was a book. We now know much more.
So much more.
So this one, I went digging, and I spent quite... Actually, I probably should have been doing more homework, and instead I was digging up folklore today, trying to find some good ones here in the book. And so I came across some decent ones I'm going to go through, okay? I first searched for book. I found a couple, because once we're talking about a book, we might as well talk about a book here. So let me give you a couple on the book. I thought this one was good. The power of healing is destroyed if a healer accepts money in the payment of services.
Hmm.
Okay.
So if you don't pay in cash, it doesn't work? Is that what it's saying?
Evidently, it says the power of a healing is destroyed if the healer accepts money in payment of services. So they need to be doing it for free.
Okay.
Otherwise, they don't heal again.
Okay.
It says here, a number of people refused to explain their methods of curing when they learned that these remedies were going to be printed in a book which would be sold.
Yeah, I bet. It's amazing what he was able to get. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of the actual hoodoo text. We might look at that in the Patreon episode.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'll be honest with you, too. And really taking a look at what his books were, if you really take a look at the folklore of Adams County, when you get into like witchcraft, ghost, hoodoo, those are the biggest sections out of the whole book. Which is mean. So obviously he was very interested in that stuff.
It paved the way.
Exactly. Yeah, this one's 10,578. It says reading the back of the book is unlucky. If you read the back of the book first, it's unlucky. Okay.
Oh, okay.
This one's talks about snoring. So then I'm kind of jumping around. Okay. 5,878. Snoring can be stopped if you tell the sleeper to quit.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Wrong.
You got to wake him up. It's only going to be a short respite. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to work for a few minutes.
All right. These ones are pretty good. Gosh, I remember which one it was. I think this had to do with nightmares. Okay. So 5,910. Put a knife under your pillow to prevent nightmares.
Oh, God. That sounds like that could go wrong.
It gets worse. 5,912. Put an open pocket knife beneath your pillow for nightmares.
Boy, you're going to hurt something.
Well, if that doesn't work, you can always do this one. The next one's cure nightmares by laying a pair of scissors under your head at night.
Why? Why are your face is real close? Wake up with a knife in your sticking out of your ear. That's horrible.
And if all else fails, 5,914, you can prevent nightmares if you keep a piece of steel under your pillow. All right.
Well, that seems a little more reasonable.
A little safer.
Have to have sharp edges. I mean, can we? Yeah, I don't know.
Just three more here. To cure night sweats, this is 5,893. Lay an axe beneath your bed.
Because that person coming through the window at night might need something to take you out with. So.
However, 7,446 makes this very confusing on how to do this, because it says on this one, carrying an axe into the house is unlucky. So what the hell am I supposed to do?
You need one of those. You got to train a set of crows who can carry. Maybe the dog. Maybe you can have the dog.
Yes, have the dog carried in for you.
Have the dog bring the axe and put it under the bed.
But this last one here.
Don't tell the dog how else. Don't have that dog cutting firewood, though. Because once he knows how to use the axe.
Then it's a problem.
Boy, can you
imagine? Treats? You're not going to give me a treat?
Can you imagine? Like a rabbit. It's bacon dog who's like going to town. He axe murders the owner in the middle of the night. It's a perfect crime. See some bite marks in the handle of the axe, but they're dogs. That's weird. I don't know what it was.
He wouldn't know how to do that.
He couldn't swing. I'm not poking fun here, but did the Fanschmidts have a dog?
I don't know. You know, 1912 to 1915 might be solved right here. We may have just solved all the axe murders.
It's those axe murdering dogs. Yeah. We've heard about those.
So the last one, because whenever we do these different subjects in the folklore stuff, I always like when we do the last one and you're like, what the hell did you just say? Okay. Oh, yeah. And so here we go. This is in the miscellaneous. There's actually a miscellaneous section.
I love the fact that at all of Hyatt's work, there's some things that just can't be classified. It's like, you know, it's good.
We got literally 600 different categories, but these need a category of their own because we're not sure to put
it. Even the vampire pig wasn't in its own, it was in another category. Exactly. I think that would have made miscellaneous.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So here you go. 10,595. It says here, if you go to the circus and give an elephant a chew of tobacco, he will get mad and tear up the show. And if he sees you again, he will know you, pick up a rock, and try to kill you with it. If you run, he will follow you all over town.
Words of wisdom from Adams County.
I mean, you laugh, but I think it's pretty obvious that elephants are very anti-smoking. Anti-chew. I mean, don't even think about giving it a pipe.
Like, exactly. Man, it's so extensive. Like, you could have just ended that with, they're going to tear up the show. But no. If you see them again, they're going to know who you are. And they're going to pick up a rock and try to kill you with it.
I think the point of this story is, you know what? Play it safe when you go to the circus and just wear a disguise.
Yeah,
you know?
Especially if you're chewing.
Things get weird with the elephants, you want to be able to lose that disguise and be safe, right?
I think that may be the oddest one I've ever heard out of this whole book.
You know, I was watching, you know, how you see things on Facebook and Instagram and just, you know, your life passes by as you get distracted by stuff.
Right.
And there was this woman who looked like a big African elephant that took her hat. He reached over, grabbed her hat, and then it looks like he eats it. And then, and she's like, what the, you know, that's so-and-so just gave me that hat. And then he psychs her out. He reaches back in his mouth and pulls it out. He's like, oh, I'm just messing with you. And he gives it back. I'm like, dang, that's pretty cool.
He was trained for that.
I don't know.
Wouldn't that be freaky if he wasn't trained to do that?
I don't know, but she was getting ready to light a cigarette. So could have got real bad. Oh, man. That's all I'm saying.
Could have got rough. Wow. All right. Well, there you go. Thanks to Dr. Hyatt for Harry Hyatt for that. I fear that was a good ending to our folklore.
Don't give that elephant an axe. I'll tell you that right now.
That's right.
Good God.
Man, I want to see that. All right. So let's wrap things up and get things wrapped up for this episode by getting us to the question of the day.
Real quick. I can't let this go yet, Chris. you've seen that the Winnie the Pooh movie where Winnie the Pooh is like a serial killer. Have you seen
that? Oh, no.
Yeah, it's like a new controversy because Winnie the Pooh just went into the public domain like earlier this year or something.
Really?
And they made a horror movie. I haven't seen it, but basically it's like he's like a serial killer. It's like dark, apparently.
Like, is he,
can you
like
imagine what Dumbo
honey?
Would look like? Like, if the same people did that with Dumbo and then, like, followed.
Dude, we should make it based off of that folklore. If they, like, a killer elephant, a killer Dumbo that you give tobacco
elephants,
to.
These elephants are going crazy, Chris. I can think of five instances where elephants went wild and, like, took out people.
Exactly.
One got hit by lightning in Oquaqua over not too far between Iowa and Illinois up north. Yeah. And it was tied to a tree, and this lightning bolt hit the tree and went straight to the elephant.
Oh,
fell
my
over
gosh.
Dead. Yeah, there's we went over there on a road trip. And then there's another elephant that had, like, died from diabetes eating too many candy. It's over around Springfield. It was buried. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah. Wow. Boy, I tell you. Yeah, jeez, elephants. Crazy. Don't cross an elephant, Chris.
Yeah. All right.
We're back.
No,
what's going
you're
on?
Serious. I'm curious about this.
Got distracted
Winnie
by the
Pooh.
Elephants.
You got distracted by by bears and elephants.
Dumbo with an axe, man. Jesus. Watch out.
I'm really liking the idea of you know, Dumbo the killer.
I got a record of losses to maintain here, Chris. Let's get
back to let's do this.
Day.
Okay. Yeah. So here's the question of the day. In an 1860 election for president, Stephen Douglas was second in the popular vote, but only won two states in the Electoral College.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Can you name one of those states? I'll give you a couple hints here. So there were 33 states in the Union at the time. So that eliminates a lot of the mountain states. So that helps you. And then the second hint here was one of those states was in the Confederacy that Douglas won. So that's about the best I can do for you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I know that he was Illinois' boy. It was before Lincoln got. I don't know, man. Gosh. I'm going to say, and I don't have any really confidence at all, I'm going to say Illinois and Missouri.
If you were to pick one of those, which one would it be?
Illinois.
If you were to pick the other one,
which one okay, would that I don't need your sympathy, Chris. I don't need your sympathy. Give it to me like a man, all right? If I got it wrong, just tell me. All right, so I screwed the pooch on that. Is what
you kind of did, but you kind of got it right. Missouri was the right one.
Well, you said that I would get it right if I got one of the two, right?
Yeah, so you're
I'm one.
Okay, so you gave me two states, and you got one of them. Okay.
So I'm a winner. I'm a winner.
We'll take the W.
I'm going to celebrate with a wiener here in a little while.
Okay. So yes, Missouri.
Have the meat sweats in about 10 minutes.
Exactly. Well, I put an axe under your bed. You'll be good. Yes, Missouri was one of them. The other one was the state of New Jersey. They were the only two states that actually had electoral votes that went to Stephen Douglas in the 1860 election.
Interesting, New Jersey. I wouldn't have guessed that.
Illinois, Lincoln was won by Illinois.
Yeah.
However, here's the crazy thing, and I wrote these down. Lincoln ended up having 1.8 million votes, had 80%, 180 electoral votes. Douglas had 1.3 million votes. Okay.
Is that right?
The next person down the list had like barely 300,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. There was a Southern Democrat, John Breckinridge, who received 72 electoral votes. And then John Bell, a Constitutional Union member, won 39 electoral votes. So there you go.
Okay.
So we're not talking about you know what? I lied. We are talking about the 1860 election because there's something that happened in Adams County right before this election came up that has never, luckily, happened since. And that was a riot, Travis.
Ooh.
Yes.
Okay. Well, what's going on? I'm not too familiar with
this. It's called the Stone Prairie Riots, and it happened in our neck of the woods growing up in the Payson-Plainville area. And it was quite the ruckus, so much so that shots were fired and people were injured.
Ugh.
Yeah, the only riot that we know of that ever happened in the Adams County area, and we're going to talk about it on the next episode of Wild Quincy because it sounds like it's like I'm trying to make it almost sounds like it's like dark, but it's crazy story, dude. Super crazy story.
All right,
we're going to talk about it.
Well, I'm on the edge of my seat. I look forward to hearing it.
We'll have that coming up for you in 2 weeks for you Patreon fans. We'll have a Wild Things episode coming your way next week, so be listening for that. We'll dig into more with Harry Hyatt, maybe find some of those weird, maybe those R-rated ones that we don't ever get to. Maybe we'll throw some of those in there.
Oh my gosh.
There's dark, there's ones that we can't talk about on this version. We'll talk about that coming up. Travis, before we wrap things up for this episode, first of all, I'll go ahead and say it. Thank you so much for former Mayor Chuck Schultz coming on and talking with us. And as always, we love having him on here. We could have pretty much just a 10-hour long episode with him and it would never be boring, right?
No, yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. We appreciate Chuck. And Chuck is quite the evangelist for Wild Quincy and says a lot of kind words out. And we really appreciate people like Chuck who spread the word. And if you want to support us, Patreon's obviously a great way to do it. But honestly, just the end of the day, tell a few people about us. We appreciate that as well. You can find us on the social channels that you would probably expect to. We're kind of holding out on TikTok because who knows how that's going to go down with the whole Chinese government. WildQuincy@gmail.com is probably your best way to get a hold of us. You can also text or leave a message on our phone line at 612-666-9453. That's 612-666-WILD. Love to hear from you. And I think that's everything, Chris.
I think you got all the bases there. So thanks to everybody for listening. For Travis Hoppe, and I'm Chris Ketters, and you've been listening to Wild Quincy. We'll catch you guys next time.
Take care, everybody.
Wild Quincy is released every other Tuesday and is produced by Chris Ketters and Travis Hoppe. Sound designed by Downdraft Sound and Editing, and music by Travis Hoppe Music. I'm Bo Beecraft, and thanks for listening to Wild Quincy.